This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.
So this paper, like everything where I come from, has three parts. The first is an historical argument about how we came to understand contract as being a strict liability regime, when in fact, in the past, it wasn't that. The second discusses justifications for the switch from seeing contract as a fault-based regime to the strict liability regime. And the last one, which I'll really brush over very quickly, is discussion of the contract tort boundary in products liability. And I'll talk about the historical part itself in two parts. First is the familiar part. So the familiar part of the historical argument is about tort law. There, the conventional wisdom, which I think is right, holds that up until the 19th century, tort law was basically concerned with causality, and over the course of the 19th century, the negligence principle gained ascendancy. It organized the field in new ways, leading it to be understood through the popular slogan, no liability without fault. One sees the new framework in treatises on tort that began to appear after the middle of the 19th century, and in the development and refinement of particular doctrines, most importantly, contributory negligence, assumption of risk, and damnum absque injuria, which I won't get into here. The background for the development of tort doctrine was an explosion of industrial accidents in the last third of the 19th century, which made tort a serious economic battleground. That much is familiar, and for most people, despite some argument about details, it's pretty much agreed upon. The less familiar part of the argument relates to contract. And here, the modern mantra is that contract is a regime of strict liability, meaning that liability is absolute, or in other words, that the reason for non-performance is irrelevant to the characterization of breach or to the remedy for breach. But up until the second half of the 19th century, contract was actually understood as a fault-based regime. Most important reason for this is that contract as a category was understood directly through the typical contractual relationships that constituted the larger category of contract. So this was a world inhabited by people in relational pairs. Bailor and bailee, principal and agent, master and servant, vendor and purchaser, landlord and tenant, husband and wife, and the list actually goes on. Within the relational pairs, actors had standardized duties whose contours were shaped by the relation itself. Individual agreement tailored these duties on the margins, but even though there were certain duties that could be characterized as absolute, it was much more typical for those duties to be framed in terms of reasonable skill, reasonable diligence, or reasonable care. And it was the failure to meet that standard of care that triggered contractual liability. So the basic standard of liability was one of fault, even though objectively defined. It was defined by external standards, not by whether the person was thinking bad thoughts when committing a lack of care. In the late 19th century, strict liability comes into its own, and then, as in tort, only through a reworking of the framework of thinking about contract. And the transformation works on two levels. First, there's a reevaluation of the source of obligation. And second, there's a new account of the basic purpose of contract. In terms of the source of obligation, parties were conceived of as making private law for themselves, rather than entering into pre-existing standardized relations whose content was given by custom or law. In terms of the purpose of the contract, there was a decline of the view of the parties entering into a given type of cooperative endeavor, and a rise of the view of contract as a tool for allocating particularized and accountable risks. Perhaps the most intuitive way to think about this is to consider how lawyers viewed the paradigm kit or core cases over the course of the century. So the thought experiment, you know, wake up an early 19th century lawyer in the middle of the night and say, what's contract? And as likely as not, he'll start to tell you about duties arising in particular classes of contract, and as likely as not, he'll talk about bailment. Ask him where... ask him where those duties come from, and he'll undoubtedly say from the nature of bailment. And so you'll press him and say, where does the nature of bailment come from? And he'll say, well, from the common law or from custom, but he'll certainly not say from the agreement of the parties. They've simply entered into this pre-existing relation. Now, ask about the particulars of the duties, and he'll differentiate by types of bailment, and this is more detailed in Richard Epstein's paper, but there are three basic ways to do the bailment. It could be for the bailee's own benefit, and then he's held to a high level of care, or he'll be liable even if he's guilty of only slight negligence or slight neglect. If the bailment is for mutual benefit, he'll be held to ordinary care, and if he's a gratuitous bailee, he'll be held only to slight care, or he'll be liable only if he's exhibited gross negligence. So by the late 19th century, maybe too many bailments cases were embarrassments for American lawyers because they were about bailments of people, hiring out of slaves. But I don't think that's why bailment sort of faded as a category. In any case, by the late 19th century, if you wake up another lawyer, he's likely, especially if he went to law school, which is something that his early 19th century counterpart certainly did not do, and even more so if he went to Harvard, he's likely to talk about mutual executory promises rather than about some pre-existing relation, perhaps for the future delivery of an agricultural commodity, perhaps for some service. If he's particularly advanced, he will think very little about cooperative activity. He might even be ready to characterize the parties simply as allocating risks or betting on the future price of this commodity and nothing more. Right? So he'll have already come to see liability sort of as mutual insurance, a kind of scheme that's much more intuitive to think about in absolute terms. So just as in tort, this required a new organizational scheme and development or refinement of doctrines that were there or were waiting to be born. There was plenty of academic energy to do the work, and this brought on new articulations of rules on formation, a refashioning of the law of consideration, and heightened emphasis on intention in the rules of interpretation, intention rather than thinking about what category of relationship these parties are actually in. So in all, contract and tort were absolutely critical to what eventually comes to be called classical legal thought or late 19th century legal science. Their modernization in the late 19th century entailed really switching their respective positions on fault. Okay, so now to try to explain what were late 19th century theorists when they reworked the role of fault in private law. The short answer is that they thought, like their European counterparts, that they were developing the science of law and that they were articulating the structure of law under a liberal idea of freedom. So the idea was to elaborate the conceptual structure under which each person had the maximal freedom of action that could coexist with like freedom of action for everybody else. In tort, this meant abandoning strict liability, because strict liability represented state-imposed liability detached from wrongdoing. Now, they all understood that negligence also imposed a limitation on freedom of action, but they would counter, negligence imposes such a limitation only where the action is a wrongful violation of the rights of others. The state is imposing responsibility, but only for actions that went beyond the rights of the injurer, and thus, since the injurer doesn't have a privilege to violate others' entitlements. And thus, the state is only protecting pre-existing entitlements rather than pursuing some public purpose or redistributive purpose. This created all kinds of doctrinal tensions, but the basic idea was clear, if not truly coherent. So long as wrongdoers were liable to compensate for injuries they caused, only wrongdoers are liable to do so, then the state is not intervening in their autonomy, and thus the border between the public and the private is strictly upheld. The shift in contract is analogous, even though it entailed the opposite conclusions regarding fault, and drawing a firm boundary between public and private is still crucial. So take the example again of bailment, or of agency, or of marriage. As long as these are based on pre-given types of relations, then enforcement is in a strong sense a public matter, because the content of the duties that's implied in these relationships stems from the law and not from the agreement. The relations then are much like status. Entry is voluntary, which is not like status, but once inside, the incidents of the relation are given. Now, when late 19th century theorists try to recharacterize agency as stemming wholly from agreement, or when they take pains to shift bailment away from contract completely, certainly when they do so for gratuitous bailment, or when they try to distinguish between contracts and quasi-contracts, or when they shift questions of interpretation to focus on intent rather than on which category of relations the transactions fit, they're reiterating the same basic maneuver. They're setting up contract as a realm governed by the parties and their promises rather than by the legally given obligations. Fault standards were problematic because they were public. The content was from the law and not from the parties. Once that shift was made, it's a short step to construing the self-imposed obligations as absolute. The image of absolute liability heightens the sense of party control and party autonomy, since it's always assumed that the parties could, if they wished, contract for any other standard of liability within their contract. Now, this combination changed the shape of private law. If in the early 19th century, contract and tort mixed without firm distinctions, by the end of the century, the image of contract as the core of private law had emerged, with tort being an aspect of private law, but a more regulatory aspect, geared toward public protection of private entitlement. Now, teasing contract and tort apart was one aspect of creating a divide, firm divide, between public and private. And one of the key doctrinal tools in doing so was this exchanging the positions of contract and tort on fault. Now, when the legal realists began examining this system, not so long after it was sort of fully fleshed out, they adamantly attacked its weaknesses and its incoherences, and they point out that objective standards of defining negligence blurred the boundary between negligence and strict liability. They noticed that many areas of tort still carried strict liability, either by common law or later by legislation. They showed how objectivism in contract blurred the boundary between actual consent and law-imposed standard of behavior, and that in turn blurred the boundary between contract and tort, and on and on. And on top of the internal critique, they pointed to what was eventually called social legislation as part of the regulatory environment in which contract and tort were embedded that couldn't be ignored when viewing the system as a whole. So in other words, they shattered the explanatory or justificatory basis of the classical structure. But classical legal thought is something of a zombie. Even if the justification or the idea articulating the idea of articulating the instantiation of freedom in law was no longer persuasive, right? If the soul was gone, the body remained, the structure and its animating ideas still worked, at least as far as arguments could be, at least as arguments that could be summoned in legal discourse. So some of these ideas are the ones we still think of as central to contract, right? That contract is centered around party sovereignty, that liability beyond consent is anomalous, that contract is more private than tort, which is more regulatory, or that strict liability is more interventionist than negligence. All these survived, unmoored from the basic idea of justifying the mass of rules as the very shape of liberty. So let me quickly then just say a couple of words about what happens later and about products liability. This is much more detailed in the paper, but I'll do this fast. So in the 1960s, products liability emerged as a field that seemed to incorporate the legal realist critique of the classical structure. Injuries from products were a social problem to be addressed through law. The avenue was to blur or re-blur the boundary between contract and tort, first by eviscerating the doctrine of privity of contract, which in essence meant abandoning the idea that the parties were the sole source of their obligations, and then by eliminating the requirement of fault in a tort action. The interesting thing is that the classical structure, again, didn't actually die. And in the 80s and 90s, a host of voices, both in case law and much more adamantly in academic scholarship, began to critique products liability in a very particular way, by reasserting the distinction between contract and tort. The high point of this literature is the contractualist movement of products liability, which advances the thesis that if the parties are left alone to contract, they'll reach efficient contracts over product safety. Now, importantly, contractualists see their claim as one that relies on a strict boundary between contract and tort, and on the idea that the place for strict liability is contract, and the place for fault is tort. So the interesting thing for me, this is the last few words here, the interesting thing from my perspective is not the bottom line of the position on expanding or contracting liability or even of establishing freedom of tort, right, rather than what we think of as freedom of contract. What I find interesting is that many of these arguments are framed as forgetting of the lessons of legal realism or of history further back, as if contract really could be conceived of as completely private and not a mode of social regulation every bit as much as tort. Okay, so I'll stop there. Please.
In terms of the boundary line, I do think it's very useful to stress a point which I don't think you stress quite enough in this paper, which is the willingness to sort of have standard contract solutions in cases of commercial non-performance, and then to sort of think generally about the situation as one of torts when you have property destruction or personal injury, so that occupiers' liability, medical malpractice, product liability, and so forth, all get pushed on the tort side of the line. But once one does that, at this point, there's a different part of the history that you don't refer to, which is suggestive that this is a mistake, as usual. For example, the early workman's compensation systems, which drove out the negligence, contributory negligence system, were all contractually formed, not hypothetically, but you go back in the 1860s and 1870s and you see detailed agreements which adopt these formulas with the broad coverage, limited liability, willful misconduct defenses, and they're done by contract. You then go into the 20th century and you start looking at the product liability stuff. What happened is people, overcame the transactional cost barrier, managed to make dealers agents for manufacturers and so forth, and that the rise of both product liability in a case like Greenman versus Uber Power and in Henningsen, and the rise of medical malpractice in a case like Tumpel, all in the early 60s, essentially all began, we see there's a contract here, so it's no longer a high transaction default cost explanation, but we think these contracts are invalid, and they give a bunch of dumb reasons as to why that ought to be the case. And so the question is, if you're trying to do this sort of history, don't you think it's sort of important to sort of understand that the classical synthesis really was one of figuring out the distinction between stranger cases and non-stranger cases, and that the breakdown of the system came when large classes of non-stranger cases got put into the tort class? By contract invalidation, remember, Henningsen says these warranties are hereby invalid. You look at the restatement third on torts, it says, any effort to limit freedom of contract and product liability cases is per se illegal. The equality of bargaining power and imperfect information is assumed automatically without proof. That's section 18.
I think the distinction between stranger cases and non-stranger cases is definitely informative for figuring out how we got where we are. I don't think that it's a distinction that does nearly as much work as it might have done in a different world. So one of the sort of standard pat pieces of since the late 19th century of all kinds of critics of legal science has been, well, once upon a time when we were yeoman farmers, we could organize law in a particular way, and now we can't. I don't think is right. So things are too complicated now to really rely on one agreement and another agreement and another agreement. So I think that even though that argument has lots of problems, and historically it was its rhetoric was way beyond what its historical validity was, I think there's a core of truth to that argument. So that contracting is a fabulous thing, but limited in terms of the kind of social goals that we think can be achieved when we imagine it as unregulated. Now, as far as what parties did or didn't manage to do, say, in workers' compensation, there were workers' compensation that were sort of firm-specific workers' contractual workers' compensation. And and there were all kinds of, at the very same time, state legislation on the same issues.
That's wrong.
And there were
the contracts came first. The unambiguous.
There were also contracts that came first, but certainly there were plenty of workplaces that didn't have workers' compensation contracts, and that the first thing that it, that imposed workers' compensation on those particular workplaces was legislation. So
it's, that
yes, and those contracts were not particularly good at generating an industry-wide workplace safety. So they were a failure in the sense that the major, well, there was an explosion of industrial accidents in the late 19th century. There was no explosion of industrial accidents in the late 19th century. There was a huge increase.
But attributable to industrialization, not to
absolutely.
The contract framework.
No, but the contract framework wasn't enough to stem the tide.
No, that's what, there's got to be evidence for that, as opposed to the situation that it would have been higher without those contracts. In fact, I mean, there's some very good papers which suggest that if you look at industries, the ones in which they did not have workers' compensation programs, it's because they were inefficient, and in those cases where there were team production, they did have it, which is a kind of instructive situation.
Okay. We can disagree about that. I think that there's also a conceptual claim in the paper about what you can achieve by contract and what you can't, which I think which is that contracts, there are significant structural reasons why contracts among individuals will not take into account the entire sort of a generalized social good. Now, you may say that's all well and good. I'm not concerned about that. I think
if that's not what I'm saying. I think, in effect, these were global arrangements which were designed to maximize worker profits.
And this is you all.
They were designed to maximize firm profit. They were not designed to maximize welfare overall.
Welfare, you can't get the profits unless you basically keep the workers in the business.
There's lots of questions about how competitive you have to be about workers as opposed to... That may be true. In any case, we disagree about what contract did or didn't achieve in the late 19th century. I think it's an interesting question.
Once we take from you that social values are part of contract law, which explain the shift that we are talking about, right, from the 19th century to what we have now, right? That the contract is not just something between the parties, but social values are part of it. Then, as you argue, right, fault became more and more relevant, right? Because fault is so you assume that fault first of all is objective, and since it's objective, it is a true fault. Social values could be integrated into contract law. And I think, my question to you is whether the possible explanation or a possible characterization to the shift could be a bit different, which is that in the 19th century, maybe we still see fault in contract law, but a different fault than what we see today, right? So if today we see fault, kind of an objective fault, which would allow courts to integrate social values, etc., and maybe in the 19th century there was fault, and I think it also relates to Richard's paper that we present later. So it was a different fault, which is more tailored to the specific parties to the contract, right? So it's more, it's fault, more like a moral fault or fault which is related to the expectation of one party from the relationship or from the other party, as opposed to a fault which we see, you know, in tort law. So generally my question is whether you could see a shift from one type of fault to a different type of fault from the 19th century to the 20th century. But today is more objective, and in the 19th century it was a different fault.
So I'd say no in terms of the characterization of the early 19th century. So my sense of fault in contract in the early 19th century is that it's completely objective. It's not about bad thoughts. It's about not performing according to a social standard, and that that standard. I think it comes out much clearer in Richard's paper on bailment, in the sections on bailment. I think that as far as what's happening in the 20th century in fault, fault becomes an opportunity to reinject social concerns. I don't actually have a very strong position on whether it's a good avenue for that injection. I think we could do it in lots of other ways, and I think the main concerns are what's the administrative cost and what are the distortions in terms of incentives. So my take on the normative project is actually sort of standard economic analysis.
So basically, are you saying that the status concept at the turn of the century versus the contract concept is really status as being a surrogate for tort-like principles? It seems to me there's two sorts of models there. One is the more radical legal realism, like Felix Cohen, or in which really there are no real general principles that work, or meta principles that work underlying, let's say, contract law versus tort law, versus somebody like Nathan Isaacs,
mm-hmm.
or later on Morris Cohen,
back and forth.
Talk about quasi status, quasi contract, and more of a conservative legal realism in which there are principles at work that distinguish contract from tort, but not necessarily meta principles that in each area of law you would ask, well, what's the rationality, or what kind of principle can we tie to this specific area of law?
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's a question or just more of an historical.
So my take on the you know, legal realism interpreted in its best light, my personal take on how to do this is to say legal realism thought there were principles that were important, that there was no structure of order in those principles that was, as a theoretical matter, equivalent to freedom, or could not be deduced from some overarching general principle. But there were principles, they had standing, one had to make arguments justifying which principle was more important in particular kinds of settings. And then there would be good reasons to say, well, let's classify, right? We don't want to think about every single case from the beginning. We don't want to invent the wheel every time we think of a new case. We'll classify cases, that also makes sense. Will the classifications eventually be contract tort property? Probably not. They'll be much narrower, which is actually, I think, a way to look back to the earlier history of the common law.
So I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit more about the history on the contract side and how it evolves from social to the idea of autonomy and parties making the law for themselves. And so you started with, you're telling a history that starts with socially imposed standards within these pair relationships. Now, so why didn't it evolve to privately imposed standards? Why is the jump from socially imposed standards still within faults? Fault with a standard socially imposed, rather,
yeah.
To a fault with a standard privately imposed. Why do we have this immediate challenge?
No, so this is a question for George Cohen. We don't. We actually have half the contract world.
No, wait. So
right?
Let's just finish this.
Lots of contracts for services and so on and so forth are actually contracts where you breach only if you don't perform according to some standard. So that still exists, but it's not the image of what we think of as the contractual world.
Why is the image of parties making the law for themselves, why is that tied to strict liability? And you said in one point that, you know, strict liability is the default, and if the parties want to, they can always kind of take it down to fault.
Right.
So now it's a question about default rules. Why is strict liability the default rules? Why isn't fault the default rule? And they can take it up to strict liability if they want.
Decent service cases.
Yeah, I mean, I think that analytically, there's no reason for one to think autonomy requires strict liability. I think it's a question of how rhetoric of independence and control is built, and I think that that in those terms, there's a lot of resonance, right? When we say to somebody, I mean, think about, so this is the trick of the analytical philosopher. I hate when people do this, but I'm back to do it. They say, well, think about how you talk to your kids, right? And when you say, okay, you've promised, you've committed yourself, and now I'm going to take you seriously as an individual by holding you to those very words, right? I'm not going to, now, this is the kind of thing, we build people's autonomy by telling them that once they've committed, they're strictly required to uphold that commitment. Is it absolutely necessary? Could we educate our kids much better if we said, no, you know, think about all things considered, is this right? You know, should you have a kind of specific kinds of justification for getting out of this commitment or promise that you've made? Very, very possibly. I don't think we would really sacrifice the idea of autonomy, but intuitively, there's a very strong rhetoric that links those things. I don't think it's necessary analytically. Richard is saying maybe it is. Yes.
I just want to say parenthetically, I think that's a tremendously foolish way to talk to children, but it's quite clear that people deal with their kids. The kids make promises all the time. And sometimes you forgive them if they don't break, if they break the promise, if you know it wasn't their fault, and sometimes you don't.
Yes.
I think your initial instinct not to fall back on the trick is the right one.
Okay, but before we go, let's forget about that. Think about what lots of people have said about all kinds of programs, you know, whether we're talking about contract, things that have elements of forgiveness in them, right? They say, well, this infantilizes people. You're not taking them seriously if you don't have them take responsibility for their actions. This kind of rhetoric, I'm not saying that this is good, but the rhetoric.
Not when you forgive people. That is a big difference.
I'm not saying that this is a good mode. I'm just saying that it sits very deep in the way people understand what autonomy is.
In ordinary rhetoric. So if somebody loses his job because he's incompetent, you know, doesn't work very well, I think it's infantilizing to say to that person, well, you're, you know, a fantastic person, and so forth. But if the person is laid off because of a depression, we don't. It's not infantilizing to say that, you know, that person needs help. But let me ask you about your paper. This is related. I get the sense that, so you make this big distinction between social value, you know, the interest coming from social values and the interest being, you know, emerging from the people, the parties. Or I may have had the same reaction that I did, which it's not a good description of law and economics. If that's what you had in mind. Because law and economics is just maximizing social welfare. And individuals, you know, are useful to the extent they know their interests better than other people do. But they don't always. And often, as we were talking about before, when they're negotiating contracts because of transaction costs, you know, they can't even take into account their own interests. And that, you know, that leads to all of the aspects, from the law and economics perspective, that leads to all of the aspects of contract law, which, unlike Richard, I think it's 98% of contract law, where the courts are essentially imposing duties on people that they didn't voluntarily take on themselves because they didn't have, you know, they didn't have the time and so forth to do that. So that's one point. My other point is just when you go through your examples, I mean, some of them are better. So for a law and economics person, obviously when two people enter into a contract that hurts a third party, you know, you're going to want to infringe on their autonomy or what have you in order to deter them from doing that. But you'll have more ambitious examples. And the one that really struck me was the one having to do with non-pecuniary losses. I just didn't understand this. You said, there's a flaw in the contract setting. The informed rational buyer will not want to buy insurance for pain and suffering damages, but will want the seller to consider such damage when investing in safety. Unless the parties can rely on some obligation outside their bargaining, there's a built-in hole preventing the optimal arrangement between them. I don't understand that. I mean, you know, you can imagine the party saying, you know, if you take your assumption literally, you can imagine the party saying, well, if you cause pain and suffering, you know, you have to pay to some third party or something like that, or Why is there a hole there? There may be a tension between what the parties want, but why can't they design a contract that, all right, suppose that transaction costs are zero, why wouldn't we think that the contract that they designed would be optimal for them, given the sort of tension, and that there's no reason for the court to step in with, what do you call them, obligations outside the book of the party?
Okay, so on the first point, I completely agree that there's economic analysis that doesn't, so in my take here is that, you know, there's good economic analysis and there's economic analysis that isn't as good. Good economic analysis does exactly what, you know, what I'm doing at the end of the paper. Economic analysis that isn't as good doesn't see or sort of uses some economic arguments, but basically as a cloak for what is in essence a libertarian argument and not a valid one. So I completely agree. In terms of the non-pecuniary damages thing, maybe the word hole isn't right and the word tension is better, but this is completely an economic argument, right? And it's basically relies on Alan Schwartz's paper on this that says for non-pecuniary damages, we might actually need some third, he calls it an administrative body or some, right? It's not going to be covered, at least not covered optimally in what we think of as normal bargain. Now,
well, why do you need an administrative body? Something like
contract. So,
why
what's?
Do you think that? I don't understand why you need it.
Because the question is, how am I going? So, if you could actually get someone to pay a third party, but we never see that, right? There's no anti-insurance. Sorry.
The workman's compensation system supports by contract in the 19th century.
The workers' compensation system did not set up payment to third parties. They didn't cover this entire thing. Third parties to adjudicate are fine. That's we have that in the court system as well. That's the right. There is no anti-insurance, as far as I know, in the actual world. It's a problem that there are social losses that I don't want to buy insurance for, that may be part of our bargaining situation, right? That much is agreed.
I'm just not sure. So if you could imagine the party saying that you should pay me for my non-pecuniary loss. Now, from my perspective, the advantage of that is it's less likely that you'll engage in the action that causes the non-pecuniary loss. But I'm going to have to pay you more in order to get the
right, and there's a strong economic argument that says that we won't want that kind of insurance.
Yes, what's the third party solution? I don't, you know, I can see the party saying
you raised the third party solution.
You'll pay somewhat less than the full amount. What's the third party solution?
Third party solution would be, say, administrative regulation that generated the level of safety, or at least had some kind of additional level of safety that you had to live by beyond your incentives to incorporate safety
as a
measure of ensuring
my. The administrator would just set up a bunch of rules about how people should behave. And
this is Alan Schwartz's,
right.
Suggestion in the paper. This isn't my particular suggestion, but the fact that this tension is difficult to contract around, I think, is an economic insight. It's not an insight against the economic analysis of law, anything but. I mean, at least that's how it is meant in the paper. Yes, George.
I wanted to go back to a point I think that Lauren was getting at least in part, and that is, one way to think about the switch, which is I think complementary to what you're saying, is to go back to Holmes and his opinion in the Globe Refining case, which is one of the early statements of the strict liability idea. And you know, one way to understand that case, the way I understand it, is that's really a goods case, and where the market damage rule makes a lot of sense, and so the fault principle, I mean, the strict liability principle gets developed because the goods case becomes the paradigm case, right? That's what we sort of think of as contract law, as opposed to the servers case being the paradigm case, and so you know that's how we might have gone down that path, and so that's one, you know, one way to think about it. And one other thing that's always interesting about that case, and it relates to something that Saul's going to talk about. And that is, contract doctrine never developed the idea that not including a liquidated damage clause made the contract uncertain. Right, you know, you can, you know, the price term was always key, and quantity and was relatively key, but damages terms were not, right? And Holmes and others never saw any problem or any tension between the idea that, you know, you have to encourage, you know, parties to put in, you know, make a more complete contract, but not in the damages area. You know, the damages area, you had no problem sort of saying, you know, default rule and, you know, what the parties would have wanted and all that kind of rhetoric. So I just think that's kind of interesting that, and I don't know whether there's a historical explanation for why that might have developed that way as opposed to some other, but just an observation.
Yeah, those are very interesting ones. I have a speculation about the, not one that's very worked out about that last, the last piece, which is that it was quite important for theorists like Holmes to do something that contributes to what they considered the certainty of law, and in the following way: taking damages as much as possible away from the jury in the sense of do what you like, and bringing it to the judge. Now, if that is your goal, it's going to be very tricky to say, well, when the parties haven't said what the damages are, now the contract itself is uncertain. That is, I think the search for a rule of law that would make sense of damage measures was actually a big project of legal science. It's a puzzling project for me, but I think Holmes is actually an interesting character there. It's definitely something that was one of the real practical issues that brought together what we think of judicial role and what we think of actual contract rules and what we think of what the parties can do as opposed to what they can't do.
Do you want to take a couple minutes to summarize or take another question?
I'd take another question, if there is one, or a cup of coffee.
This audio file is a production of the University of Chicago Law School. Visit us on the web at www.law.uchicago.edu.